Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Welcome to Charlotte Talks. I'm David Borak, sitting in for Mike Collins. Today, we're talking about homelessness and housing in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County, or maybe more accurately, the lack of housing. The pandemic has cost people jobs and money, and some haven't been able to hold on to their housing. The federal moratorium on evictions has helped to prevent some from becoming homeless, but that ends on June 30th. Charlotte's housing market right now is on fire, and that's not a good thing if you're at the low end of the income scale. Houses almost seem to sell overnight, and we've seen an apartment building boom in recent years that primarily addressed the upper end of the market, but not the rest of us. The average rent in Charlotte is now over $1,400 a month. That's just not affordable to people making minimum wage. That's all to say that it's more important than ever right now to talk about and address and prevent homelessness. With me to talk about this today are Courtney Licaria, Housing and Homelessness Research Coordinator for Mecklenburg County Community Support Services. Welcome, Courtney.
Thank you for having me.
Karen Pelletier is with us. She's the Division Director of Housing Strategy, Innovation, and Alignment for Mecklenburg County. Hello, Karen.
Morning. Thank you.
James Lee is an affordable housing leader and a peer counselor at the Stanton Greenspan Center and a former homeless Charlottean. Welcome. It's good to see you again, James.
Good to see you too, David. Thank you.
And Liz Clayson-Kelly is CEO of Roof Above, once upon a time known as the Urban Ministry. It runs shelters, provides supportive housing, and other services. Hello again, Liz.
Good morning, David.
Well, Courtney, I wanted to start with you, and I wanted to let folks know, first of all, that you write the Building Bridges blog on the Mecklenburg County website. It's actually on mecklenburghousingdata.org. And if you're interested in this issue of homelessness and housing in Charlotte, it's a must read. It's got all the information you need, the latest research, looking at what's happening in other places. It really is a major contributor to the conversation. So I really appreciate it. I've learned so much from that, Courtney. But let me ask you, can you frame the problem for us here right now as far as how many people in Mecklenburg County are currently experiencing homelessness and who are they?
Absolutely. So as you know, we update this number every month. We look at how many people are currently experiencing homelessness in our community. Right now, that number is a little over 3,000. So if we think total number of people experiencing homelessness, 3,263. Of that total, there are about 400 families. There's about 2,000 single individuals. And there's a little over 100 unaccompanied youth. So that's single individuals between the ages of 18 and 24. We also have around 250 veterans, 587 people experiencing chronic homelessness. So that's long-term homelessness. So that number we consider the floor. That doesn't count all the folks who are doubled up, who are staying week to week and paying to stay in hotels and motels. And then also all the folks who are experiencing housing instability so that they may be paying more than 30% of their income to housing related expenses. So bare minimum 3,263.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the 500 to 600 people that are experiencing chronic homelessness. And just say a little more about that group.
So that's folks who have had more than 12 months of homelessness history. So it could have been a number of episodes or one long episode combined with a disabling condition. So we're thinking of the folks who are really vulnerable, who've been experiencing long periods of homelessness, coupled with disabling conditions that require both housing and supportive services.
Mm-hmm. And people may be curious, how do we know this? How do we have this exact number? And I know that this has changed over the years. I remember the days when the number that we had was based on the point in time count, which is done every January. It's required by the federal government. And it was actually done by going out on the street and trying to count. And that got at this in one way, but we have a much different system now.
We do. And we have a really fabulous data team, our HMIS data team. So our Homeless Management Information System, or HMIS, is where we keep all of our information for folks who touch the system. And so whereas we used to only have this one number that for every year we had an estimate, that one night snapshot, the point in time count, that was really our only estimate of homelessness. It's an count because it's one night. Now we're able to update this number every month. So folks who touch our system, we create a by name list. So we know exactly who's coming in, who's leaving. And that means that we can then break that down to look at inflow into homelessness, outflow out of homelessness. We can break that down by household composition, by homelessness type. We can disaggregate that by race and ethnicity and really break down those trends. So then we can look at how does that inform solutions?
And you kind of just hinted at it, but why did the county decide to start getting into more detail here on this?
So the county really has an invested interest in helping to address housing instability and homelessness, and saw this gap early on. So this is going back to 2015, where Community Support Services, the department that I work for at Mecklenburg County, decided to invest in data, not only making sure that data coming in is high quality, but data going out, it can be used in the community. And so that helped inform our Mecklenburg Housing Data Dashboard, where we push out data, we push out information and research. And then we also help the community find ways to use it.
Just quick question for Liz. You are somebody who provides services to the homeless community here. Are you a regular reader of the research that comes out of Courtney's office, and how does it affect what you do?
Yes. Well, I think, you know, you asked the question about data. It is so critical when we have social problems that feel intractable that we use all the tools in our toolbox to try to solve them. And so I think having data-driven decisions and innovation is critical. And so the most successful communities are using the data, drilling down into individual specific level data as well as trends. And then we're designing the system, kind of recognizing what's working and what's not working. And so I am a regular reader of Courtney's blog. I joke that when she told me she was going to write a weekly blog, I thought she was crazy to make that commitment, but it is a huge commitment. But she gives this gift to our community that she's, you know, consistently looking at the data, bringing in best practice information and sharing it at a really easy to read platform. So I think it's critical that we use not just our hearts, but our hearts and our heads to address homelessness, because we know when we do, we can make progress.
And James, quick question. We were talking earlier and you said you read it.
I do. But being an advocate, working for Stan Greenspan, I want to keep abreast of all the great information that Courtney puts in her blog. And it helps me to explain in layman's terms some of the high level information that that Courtney has in the blog.
Mm-hmm. Well, Karen, you work at the county with Courtney, and you also work in the same area. I'm curious if you could help me understand, how has the county's approach to homelessness evolved in recent years?
So I think the fact that we have become so data driven is, I think, the biggest indicator, and that is what really has led the way. Our community was one of the first in the country to implement coordinated entry, which is that portal to shelter, to services for people experiencing homelessness. So really being able to implement best practices more purposefully. We are a community that also invested a great deal in housing first, which is the topic of Courtney's blog today, and what that means, bringing in national experts to really help frame our community in a way that is going to be data-driven, that is going to create evidence-based models. And then we're also able to look through that lens of data and evidence-based practice and how do we improve programs and expand programs. Funding for homeless services has almost doubled in the last 10 years, and how we invest differently, how we have manageable caseloads, how we train staff, how we train our community. So it has evolved, and all really being led by data and evidence.
You mentioned that the county has doubled its budget for homeless services. Where does that money go? What does it go towards?
So it goes through from support services for our agencies. The vast majority is to help support agencies like Roof Above, Salvation Army, Supportive Housing Communities, and others in providing those support services. We know with housing that housing is the key to end homelessness, but we also need those support services to really wrap around households to help them maintain stability. So a good portion of that funding goes to to assist agencies to provide the staff to do that. We also
Say a little more about support services. What are we talking about specifically?
So what we would really consider case management or wraparound services, really anything that a household may need to maintain housing. So from individuals that may be experiencing chronic homelessness, it's going to be things about helping people access mental health or substance use treatment if that's where they're at, getting reconnected with a primary care physician, getting people connected with employment or job training opportunities, helping build bridges with natural supports. Some of it is also about mitigating conversations or mediating conversations with landlords, teaching people how to just live indoors, live inside, maintain a household, make those connections to budgeting. Although anything that we that some folks may be able they take for granted, it's really about helping to teach people and support people, whatever that may be. So working with a case plan, helping people come up with goals. Again, really just that wraparound support.
There's a lot of talk about support services this year, as there have been some major efforts, not just in Charlotte, but in other cities, to get our homeless neighbors off the street and into semi-permanent or permanent housing. And support services seems to be a critical factor there. Mm-hmm. Courtney, I wanted to, there's a lot of lingo that's thrown around when we talk about the kinds of services that we need in order to solve this problem. Today, as was mentioned, you've written about housing first. And tell us what that is and how it fits in with some of these other things.
So Housing First sometimes gets referred to as a model, sometimes referred to as approach. You think of it as little h, little f. But ultimately, it's around providing housing first. So first starting with housing and then surrounding everything else that's needed. So the supportive services. It's not requiring conditions such as employment or sobriety in order to get housing, but starting first with housing and then surrounding the person with the support that they need to sustain it.
Mm-hmm. Another initiative the county has been working on over the past year or so is called Evaluate Upstream. And upstream is referring to people maybe who are not yet homeless, right? Say a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So, a few years ago, we started looking at just the concept of prevention in the community. So we've typically focused on downstream aspects of our homelessness system. So once folks become homeless, helping to get them quickly into shelter, and then after that, rehouse and then helping them sustain that. But often, when someone's facing eviction and that a filing's on them, it's almost too late. And so what does it look like to help prevent folks from becoming homeless and even from facing an eviction in the first place? And might that not only be smart, but also be more cost effective? And so we, Mecklenburg County submitted a grant on behalf of the Continuum of Care for the community, a planning grant to look at how can we make a more effective prevention assistance system in our community. There are lots of prevention assistance providers. So whether that's legal assistance to help folks fight evictions, whether that's like critical home repair, to help make homes up to standard, up to code for folks who are living in homes, whether that's providing financial assistance with like rent or utility assistance, that happens, but not in a coordinated way. And so what we did was take an entire year to look at how can we make a more effective prevention assistance system in our community.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that after the break. We need to take a break right now, but when we come back, we'll be talking more about the state of homelessness in Charlotte. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm David Borak, sitting in today for Mike Collins, and we're talking about homelessness in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. Our guests are Karen Pelletier and Courtney Licaria, both of Mecklenburg County, James Lee of the Stan Greenspan Center, and Liz Clayson Kelly of Roof Above. Courtney, we had to take a quick break there, but you were talking about evaluate upstream. And this is actually kind of following on something that's been going on for several years. And you've done some research with UNC Charlotte on it. What did the study that they did tell us about the situation?
So after about a year of work, really looking at, having involvement from different public and private stakeholders in the community. Actually, everybody here who's part of this panel today has been part of this work of Evaluate Upstream. We created a blueprint to look at what are the ways that we can create an effective and efficient prevention assistance system that also has positive downstream impacts. So it's not just looking at, legal assistance, home repair, that kind of thing, but also more affordable housing in our community. How do we create policies that help facilitate access to housing? How can we strengthen cross-sector supports to help families make the math work? How can we reduce that gap between the cost of housing and what households can afford? And so it's really looking at all of those pieces that can help inform solutions downstream as well. That blueprint was released in May, and it actually is the implementation of that work is going into this new strategy, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Housing and Homelessness Strategy, that's now underway. And so the work did not end, it's really just beginning and is being continued in that way.
Mm-hmm. I wanna talk some more about the strategy that's in the works right now in a few minutes. But first I wanted to turn to James. You know, we're talking about this problem so much from a policy point of view, but you've lived this. Tell us about your experience with homelessness.
Well, just like my experience is no different than a lot of people. Life happens and you make a decision and you start down this road where you find yourself sleeping on a park bench. And when you go try to find services, you have a challenge sometimes finding those services because you don't know where they are. But because I was a veteran, I was able to get through it pretty quickly with a lot of support from my family and from my friends and from the Stan Green Response Center, from a lot of folks that I've worked with since I've been housed now, still precariously, but still at least I'm not on the street anymore. But yeah, I'm a Charlotte native and I just advocate for the voices that can't be at the table. So I definitely appreciate being here and speaking for a lot of people who went through what I went through and are trying to struggle and trying to make it through life. So
so how long were you homeless?
Well, for like a lot of folks, off and on, I got divorced early 2000s. And from then up until now, I've had periods of 4 or 5 years where I was okay. I was a working addict. They call it functioning addict. But for last 7 years, I've been off and on. 2018, I was on the street the whole year. Until I went to seek some help, and my family and my friends encouraged me to go get help, and I went to a family forum, which is a place where they have veterans, and I got help through them, and just started my life back, and now I'm an advocate to try to help folks to navigate through, the homelessness situation, because sometimes it's hard.
So you're now helping other folks who are in the situation you were in. How do you do that? I mean, are you out on the street? Are you running programs? What are you doing?
What I do is I just start with my circle, right? I work with Project 704 and Judith Elise Brown last year on the 2020 census, along with the county, the city, and we did the car caravans, if you guys remember. So I work with organizations like that and with people who they serve, because most of the time I'm in where I do my work is around just the people that I work with, my colleagues. So they are all people who like they need help, right? One worked for the city for 11 years. She got two sons. One's got five children. She's out of foster care. So even in my own little square, there's folks that I try to help in whatever way I can. And branching out to work while working with the Green Sponsor, I'm able to reach out in a broader sense to other folks and just, if nothing else, help them to find out where the resources are. you know, by letting them know where the county's possibilities are.
And you're starting your own operation. What's that all about?
Yeah, I got blessed by Charisse Blackman at the Westside Community Land Trust. She donated some money so that I went to a Duke University nonprofit class with the at United Way. So I graduated from that 12-week class, and then I went to Aspire Capital, which is a business 12-week business training class. So I went through those two. And in our class at the Duke University, there's a gentleman that came from Raleigh. He created a social enterprise. And I like that model where it says it's not a nonprofit. It's a social enterprise. It's something where you're taking some folks to help them. And then, like has been said before, a lot of times when people, well, you need to put those wraparound services. So what I'm creating is a social enterprise that's going to capture folks that are homeless in my community and take them along a continuum, right? Because me knowing about the ecosystem of homelessness in Charlotte, but having gone through it, I know more things to help folks to go through that continuum of care that they need, you know, because you do need wraparound services once you do get someplace to go, because you're still dealing with, I was dealing with substance abuse. So there's still some things that you have to deal with, along with, like Courtney's saying, the housing is the first thing. After that, then you get the folks. So, but that's pretty much what I do now. Try to, a lot of folks, they can't afford to live here. So those are folks that I focus on.
Well, during the pandemic here, one of the most visible signs of homelessness was the encampments near Uptown that we called Tent City. And, you know, we've had homelessness in our city for a long time, but not all in one place like this. At least that's the way I've read this. And Liz, you and I have talked about this. But I guess, Karen, you recently gave an update to the county commission about where we are with this. If people remember that back in February, the county decided that there was actually a public health risk to the encampment, and they decided and they found money to move all these folks into hotels. And there was like 140 people living at the encampment, and other folks got into the mix there. And so we ended up moving about 200 people, a little over 200 people. What is the status of those folks now? It was originally supposed to be June 30th that they were all out of the hotels into permanent housing.
Right. So, yeah. So it was 213 individuals that we moved to hotels, and there's currently 138 people still remaining. We really spent those first several weeks just really working to engage individuals, assess what they needed, kind of where they are and what they would need to move to housing. We quickly learned, we didn't have affordable housing before COVID came in our community. We don't have it today. So we knew that the county was very committed to providing as much access to housing and services as possible. So with the support of county leadership and the board, we were able to extend those hotels through September. And that's really just to be able to get people connected to a housing resource. So it's not just that, match to a housing program, but also finding a unit in our community and finding a landlord that is going to be willing to rent to someone that is going to accept a voucher, that's going to take someone possibly with poor credit or a criminal history. And so we are going to continue to work to engage folks and just provide people that housing, because we believe in that housing first model and permanent supportive housing, and we want housing or homelessness to be rare, brief, and non-recurring. So determining what is that right size of housing, whether it's permanent supportive housing with those wraparound services, or whether it's a shorter term subsidy with support services.
Well, I think people are interested in the individuals that were moved, and you know, how many people are still in hotels, and those who have left, where have they gone?
Sure. So we currently have 138 people that are there. We do know that 40 people have chosen to leave and they could be living back outside or unsheltered. They may be accessing emergency shelter now. We have had 11 people move to permanent housing. And that's because of the great work of our community partners like Roof Above and others that are really working to help assist and engage.
Okay. From your presentation, I learned that some folks have wound up in jail. Three people have died, which is always a sad outcome for many people who are homeless. And there's some that you just don't know what happened to them, right?
Correct. Correct. I mean, the thing, many of the people that moved to the hotel had been living unsheltered for a very long period of time, for some folks years. And so moving people there is just really the first step, not just for the folks that are at the hotels, but for the other 3,200 people that Courtney mentioned earlier today, that as a community and as a priority for the county and growing affordable housing, that we want people to be able to access those resources.
Mm-hmm. Well, both the county and the city have put some money into the pot to help with possible solutions here. Where is that money being spent? What sorts of programs are in the works?
So right now, I know the county, with the assistance of FEMA for some of the assistance, is providing the access to the hotels, the security, food, laundry. Our partner agencies are having staff that are on site. The county is also providing assistance to some of our agencies like Black Love Charlotte and Heartsbeat for One on providing some of that staff shelter support, so to speak. We have, of the 11 people that have moved to permanent housing, many of them have gone to county funded programs like MEC Home or Keeping Families Together or LINC. But we are really excited about the city ESG. They're going to utilize some of their state funds to provide that rapid rehousing for up to 75 of the individuals with the lowest barriers and that can demonstrate a COVID hardship. So we're excited about that program, hoping to come online shortly with that. And that'll be a partnership with the United Way Social Serve and Catholic Charities.
Mm-hmm. Well, Liz, you've been right in the middle of all of this during the pandemic. Say a little bit about how what you do has changed and what hasn't changed and what you've been able to do during the pandemic to deal with this issue.
Yes, great question, David. So in many ways, it feels like every operational aspect of Roof Above has changed due to the pandemic. Unfortunately, homeless services kind of pre-pandemic often involved large numbers of people. And so we were crowded. And so we very quickly had to socially distance. And so for us, that meant we closed towards the beginning of the pandemic our congregate shelters. We've moved to motel-based sheltering. You know, we've served meals to go, we space, you know, we mask, all of those pieces. But I think a really important piece to note is public policy changed very quickly during the pandemic. So you had the eviction moratorium. So we actually saw, while visibly, it seemed like homelessness was exploding in our community. When you look at the data, that's not what it showed. And the eviction moratorium did seem to be a very significant protective measure along with unemployment benefits for people. But then you also had all of this additional funding. So we could do things like shelter in a motel. We had the opportunity, we converted unused college dormitories, and we started, you know, in a few weeks, we started a brand new program for men experiencing homelessness who were working. And we've had more than 100 people move from that program into permanent housing. We've had a more than 80% success rate exit to housing. It's been one of our most successful programs. And literally the team designed it on a fly. The community came together to, you know, put beds in the old dorms and fix it up. And so, you know, we really never have the opportunity where there are resources like that that come so quickly. All of the motel work we're doing, FEMA reimburses. But that's all got a timeline, right? And so we've seen hundreds of shelter beds added to our community. We've heard so loudly the community with the encampment, the community was so clear, this is not acceptable, right? When we see, when we feel the realities of homelessness, you know, the community is clear, this isn't okay. But now that money's going to go away, our system is set to begin to shrink, and which is really where this 2025 plan, the timing is great, because we're having a moment as these resources are going away, we're coming together as a community to say, okay, what does need to be the vision moving forward? How do we fund it and how do we get there? So it's this crux of moment where you see the cliff where things are gonna start to change, but you also feel the hope that we're working together to create something better together.
You know, you mentioned the funding is ending at the end of this month. We're expecting the CDC moratorium on evictions to end, which means that there could be a wave of new evictions. I'm working with other news outlets here in Charlotte right now on a project that we'll publish in the next couple of weeks that looks at this potential problem that's coming and compares it to past years and that sort of thing. And people I'm talking to everybody's kind of biting their nails about it.
So. Yeah, it's a little unknown. I mean, the great thing is there are lots of resources that have come in for rent support, right? And so we've got partners, if folks are, if you've been impacted by COVID, there are rent resources there. We're just stepping into the unknown, right? And it feels like that's happening as some of these, you know, the FEMA resources sunset at the end of September. So we've got some scaling back. At the same time, we feel like we're stepping potentially into an increase of, and what we know is rents, you know, the pandemic's been very interesting, right? Because some people have done actually very well in the pandemic. Our community, by and large, I mean, as we are in a prosperous moment, we are growing, and part of that growth is rents continue to rise. And so, you know, that is really great for some people, but when your perspective is my perspective and you see our front door every day, you know that there's a shadow side to our prosperity. And so it's up to this community to say, how do we act together to mitigate some of those shadow sides of prosperity?
Do you think that one of the side effects of the pandemic and the attention to this issue is that there is more of a will in Charlotte right now to do this?
Yeah. So again, the pandemic is so interesting, right? Because there's all this grief and loss around you. And yet I've done this work now for, 20 years, believe it or not. And I have never seen the community so unified in their support of ending homelessness. So it's like when people saw it, when they felt it, the response from the community has been phenomenal. And what we have to figure out how to do is when it's not so visible, when there's not, you know, a couple hundred tents that people are seeing, how do we continue that community momentum?
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
Welcome back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm David Borak, sitting in for Mike Collins today, and we're taking a look at homelessness in Charlotte and Mecklenburg County. My guests are Karen Pelletier and Courtney Licaria of Mecklenburg County, James Lee of the Stan Greenspan Center, and Liz Clayson-Kelly of Roof Above. And Liz, you artfully led us into the topic of the homeless strategy that's underway. And for folks that may not be up on this, back in April, Charlotte leaders announced an effort to wipe out homelessness and expand affordable housing within 5 years. It's not the first time that we've had statements like that about this issue, but it is maybe a little different this time. It's being called the 2025 Charlotte-Mecklenburg Housing and Homelessness Strategy, and it's got a couple of high-powered chairs, Bank of America executive Kathy Besant and Atrium Health CEO Gene Woods, and more than 200 people working on 9 different working groups on different issues related to this. And basically, it's a 5-year plan that will be unveiled this fall. And I think all 4 of you folks today are involved in that in one way or another. I talked about the announcement with County Manager Dina DiOrio, and here's how she described it.
We're going to be looking at prevention, better wraparound services, access to affordable housing, data, communications, and really trying to integrate all the work so we look at it from a continuum perspective as opposed to just one segment of the continuum.
Karen or Courtney, so let's talk about this first. What does the county manager mean when she talks about addressing the continuum?
So think about this like an iceberg, right? So if you think about when you're in the boat, all you see is the top of the water, or the iceberg, that's the part of the iceberg that's on the top of the water. You're only seeing a piece of the problem. And that might be, you know, the homelessness, the aspect of homelessness that we can see in our community. but there's all that piece underneath the water. And if we are only focused on the piece above, then we're not going to solve the entire issue. And so for folks who are homeless that we can see, there are also folks who are right on the edge, and we've got their similar issues. It's all about housing. And so we think about the continuum, we're looking at folks experiencing homelessness on the streets, folks experiencing homelessness in the shelter, doubled up in hotels and motels, folks who are in institutional settings who are leaving the criminal justice system, but we're also looking all the way upstream into folks facing eviction, who are experiencing cost burden, who are in substandard housing, who are in overcrowded housing. We've got to look at all of those pieces together. And that's what's so different about this effort, is we're looking at this issue comprehensively. So we're looking at it to address the issue comprehensively, but also in our approach. So it's not just the public sector, it's not just the private sector, it's both sectors coming together. And it's not just the housing sector, it's other sectors as well. We've got healthcare, we've got education, we've got transportation, we've got behavioral, other supportive services, childcare. How do you help families make the math work? And then how do you also sustain that? So really excited to have everyone at the table for this work.
Karen, did you have a few thoughts about this? Or?
Well, I was just gonna say, I mean, you referenced that it's not the first time we've made this statement as a community, or there's been other plans, and I've been involved in those plans as well. And I think it's exciting because we've learned so much from the work that's been done, and not to say those other plans were done in vain, because we created great processes out of those, but we're able to take the lessons learned from that, the fantastic work that's been done on Evaluate Upstream, and really work to make this plan so comprehensive. And to Liz's earlier point, I think just the eagerness to know that over 200 people are involved in this work is just really, I think, exciting, and how we can really create system change and do things differently, because we are called and tasked to do that. And this plan is going to be that platform for us.
Well, you've been involved in these before. I mentioned that there's over 200 people involved from all different sectors. Is that one of the things that could make a difference here?
I think it's the breadth of knowledge of all the different vantage points for folks is what's going to make this, I think, more sustainable and doable.
When I talked to the county manager about this, she was also she also noted that a lot of times we have solutions, we have programs, but they're not all talking to each other. And that seems to be part of the point here.
Absolutely. I think we've really learned that during these encampment hotels. I would say that we are learning about how are we bringing services to people differently? How do we do outreach differently? The fact that we've had substance use services on site, that we've got a clear path to detox for folks. In July, we hope to have Atrium Health on site at the hotel, working with people that need to get reestablished. We've had DSS on site helping people complete food stamp and Medicaid applications, that we're learning so much of this. So really, the if any positiveness can come out of COVID, come out of the North End encampment and the hotels, this is the time to make that happen. And because of the work that is already happening with this plan.
Well, James, as someone who has experienced homelessness, and who is now working on the issue, what does it mean to have somebody like yourself on this group? I mean, has that happened in the past, or is that something new, and why is that important?
I think this deal is different because people like me are at the table, you know, because we do bring our particular expertise to the problem to try to fix the whole system, right? Because we know what the system has done and not done for us. So we're able to come to the table to say, okay, yeah, maybe that'll work, but really this not gonna work because you're not really getting to the core. But like Courtney was saying, a lot of times, you know, when folks are homeless, they're dealing with a lot of things. So you not only have to help them with the homelessness, there's some other things that's underlying that homelessness situation that they're in. So this is different because one of the core components of this plan is to have folks like myself with lived experience. That's what they call it, lived experience. I have the lived experience to be able to articulate my journey and the journey of some of my friends and some of the folks that I advocate for, or articulate that into the conversation where we can come together for some solution, right?
What are one or two of the top things that you would like to see be discussed during this?
Everything that I've been part of it since the appreciative inquiry part of the Evaluate Upstream project, which was they brought people with lived experience into the conversation at an early stage. And then we went to the design thinking stage where we had folks like from banks and Foundation for the Carolinas. They came to talk to us about what solutions we came up with. I think this is different because already the county, the city, people have been listening to what we've been saying. And that has almost never happened. It's never happened where you've come to me as a homeless person and asked me, what do I think about getting myself out of homelessness? What do I need? Instead of like saying, okay, James, this is what you need. That's not going to be successful. It's going to be more successful if it comes from me than if it comes from outside, somebody looking at me saying, James, this is what you need to do to get off drugs.
Well, in addition to the fact that there are so many people from different organizations and government agencies involved, there's also a lot more money out there right now, right? I mean, is that playing into this?
I think sometimes we think money is all out the solution to keep throwing. But as been said before, people want relationships, right? It's more successful if you combine the work that Liz and some of the other folks are doing with the money and the relationship, right? Because you can't just keep throwing money at the situation. We right now, I'm a part of the ranking committee of the continuum of care, and we got tons of money available, but where do you spend that money? How do you spend that money? How do you spend it more effectively to where you can, the folks that you're helping can benefit more, right?
Liz, did you have a thought about this?
Well, I'll jump in. James, I might have a slightly different perspective, but one, I love the inclusion of voices of people who've experienced homelessness. I mean, really, when you look at the Housing First approach was designed just from listening. And so I think it's critical that we always design answers with the folks we serve. But I want us to be real about this real scarcity in our community, right? So with the American Rescue Plan, there was just this kind of historic, we got 178 new Section 8 vouchers in our community. And I could be wrong on this, but I think that's the largest single allotment of new vouchers in like maybe a couple decades in our community, right? But it's 178, right? It's 178 vouchers when we right now have 3,200 people are homeless and like 23,000 need for, you know, households that are 30% area mean income or less. And so I think absolutely we can collaborate better. We can be a better system. We should always be looking at those things, right? But at some level, we have to decide as a community, we have to get real about what the need is. And we have to be real about how do we invest more solutions. And what happened during the pandemic is people saw so immediately the critical role housing played, and the public sector in particular responded, and private sector. And so how do we keep that sense of urgency? Because homelessness remains a public health crisis, right? Even with our COVID numbers down, there's lots of other public health and community challenges that come with having 3,200 people in our community that don't have a place to call home tonight.
Liz, what are some of the potential solutions? And let me just note that during the pandemic here, you guys have purchased, with a lot of assistance from the community, you've purchased an apartment complex. You have purchased a hotel. Those are two possible solutions. Are those models for what we could do more of going forward?
Yeah, well, this will be like my Captain Obvious answer, but housing is the solution, right? Homelessness at its core is a housing crisis. And so housing is the solution. And as you've heard, I mean, you've talked about wraparound services. Often it's housing plus what's the level of services people need to be successful in housing. So Roof Above was really fortunate during the pandemic to make two really strategic moves. So we bought Hill Rock Estates, which is an older apartment complex. We purchased that through a complex financial deal, but definitely involved support of the city, the generosity of the community. The county is funding the wraparound services there. So at Hill Rock Estates, we bought it. We're holding rents affordable, more in that, you know, kind of what we call 60% AMI. So think, you know, $750, $850 a month. But 75 units, we're actually dropping those rents to a little less than 200. And those are units specifically for folks coming out of chronic homelessness. So those folks who are very vulnerable, have been homeless at least a year, in some cases, you know, have been homeless a decade or more. We've actually been able to house folks from the encampment motel, both in those kind of special 75 units, but in those other units as well. We've had, you know, we have folks who are working that can afford that rent, that kind of, you know, 60% AMI rent, we call it in this world. So that's been really exciting. And I'd love to say that's replicable. There's efforts going to replicate that. The reality is these older apartment buildings, you have investors from around the world competing to buy these older apartments because of the way multifamily apartments have become an investment strategy. And so
and you folks and your co-investors had to pay a market price for Hill Rock.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, we got some pushback to say, like, did we overpay? And now it looks like, based on where prices are, it's like, we got this phenomenal deal because the market is changing so quickly, right? So there are things going, trading for much higher that are much lower quality than what we purchased. But yes, it was complicated. It wasn't a bargain. But we feel like actually it's a great investment for the community because it's going to both help prevent homelessness by holding those rents affordable and then create 75 units of permanent supportive housing. And then in November, we bought a hotel. That now is underway. It's fully permitted. We are converting. We used it as a shelter in partnership with the Salvation Army for several months. And now we've just started construction. We're adding kitchens. We'll convert that to 88 apartments that will have on-site case management. The county just in their most recent budget is supporting case management there. We'll have hopefully healthcare partnerships there. And so we'll be moving 88 of our most vulnerable neighbors in chronic homelessness home, we hope, in late December, early January 2022.
Well, this homeless strategy that we've been talking about is due for a report in October. So we'll see what kinds of solutions are in there and how likely those are. I just want to touch on one more subject before we close out today. And it has to do with people's perceptions about homelessness and the way we deal with folks. This week, City Council Member Tarek Bakari said that he thinks there needs to be more tough love around that we the way we approach people with homelessness. And in particular, he singled out people who provide money and food and clothing directly to people on the street instead of to social service agencies. Here's what he said.
They're only making themselves feel good. They're hurting the ultimate folks. Perhaps we explore making that a misdemeanor. We have to do something different or we're never going to get ahead of it.
So if you missed that there, he's suggesting that it should be a misdemeanor, a crime, to give money to homeless people. And during that meeting, Councilmember Renee Johnson didn't like the sound of that.
That's something that I would never support, especially when there are so many systemic barriers for individuals who are homeless.
What about the idea of giving money to people on the street? James, you've been homeless. What?
I actually would not like to respond to that. I like him. He's a cool guy, but I don't agree with what he said.
Anybody else have thoughts on this? We got about a minute.
I think, you know, one thing to say is that you know, this is kind of what we talked about in the blog post this morning, is that too often we penalize the people instead of addressing the systems and the structures that caused the situation in the first place. And I think that that's one of the real amazing aspects of this new Charlotte-Mecklenburg housing and homelessness strategy. You know, there's two core pieces that infuse all of the work, aspects of the work. And one is that we're going to comprehensively address the systems and the structures that both cause and perpetuate housing and civilian homelessness, but then also keep front and center the people with lived experience, those folks who have been impacted by this and continue to be. And so integrating that, and I think that that's what we have to keep top front of mind in the work that we do.
Courtney Licaria of Mecklenburg County, thanks so much. Thank you, Karen Pelletier from Mecklenburg County, Liz Clayson-Kelly from Roof Above, and James Lee of the Greenspan Center. Thank you for your time today talking about homelessness here on WFAE. This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.